When you live in an area with lots of forested land, you talk about forests a lot, and so we do. They are one of the central features of the region and among the reasons why people live here. We're constantly gaining new knowledge about the relationships between forests and fire and the relationships between forests and fish. Our first guests will talk about the relationships on Thursday evening in Ashland in a program at ScienceWorks called Born of Fire and Carved by Rivers, the Ecosystem Benefits of Forest Fires and Wild Rivers. Two guests with us. Dominic Della Sala is president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute based in Ashland. Welcome, Dominic.
Thanks for having me on again, Jeffrey.
And Jack Williams is here. He's the chief scientist for Trout Unlimited, based in Medford. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Great to be here.
Good to have you both here. So let's just get an overview here and give us an idea what your organizations are about. Let's start with you, Jack, at Trout Unlimited.
Sure. Trout Unlimited's a national conservation group. We're dedicated to saving trout and salmon and their habitats or watersheds they live in. So we've got presence all across the country.
We were just establishing some bona fides on as we were getting set up here. You were once a supervisor, I understand, in the Forest Service.
Yeah, that's right. I worked for both the Bureau of Land Management and U.S. Forest Service. And yeah, I was on the Rogue River and Siskiyou National Forest here locally for a while. So yeah, this has been home for my wife and I for about 15 years.
So you've seen discussions about forest and forest management from several different angles now.
Oh, yes.
All right, we'll explore those a little further. Dominic Della Sala, tell folks about the Geos Institute if they're not familiar with you.
Yeah, you bet. So we are based in Ashland, and we're a science-based organization. Our mission is to lead the way to climate solutions that matter. And so we work with communities, land managers, scientists, and just about anybody that's concerned about climate change and what to do about it, whether we're here in Ashland or in the Tongass Rainforest.
Now, your work has been focusing of late, apparently, on fires and their civic. We had John a few weeks ago to talk about, it seems like the general view is that it doesn't matter how hot a fire burns, you think it's still pretty good for a forest ecosystem?
Yeah, I just finished a great book with 27 other scientists that looked at fires from a global perspective and a regional perspective. And what we learned through that process is that no matter where you look and no matter how hot these fires burn, nature comes back if we let it.
So there's really no such thing as a bad fire? Is that one of the things? I know we're using judgment, human judgments here, but what's the scientific point of view on that?
Well, it's certainly bad if it's affecting people and homes and firefighters. There's no question about that. But if we just look at the ecosystem effects of fire, these forests were born to burn. And the dry forest, fire is to dry forest as rain is to rainforest. There's a linkage there, and those forests really depend on fire to rejuvenate themselves.
Some of the things I've learned in recent years are rather surprising. I mean, things like tree species that only release their seeds from seed cones in fire or with the presence of the chemicals from smoke, for example.
Yeah, that's correct. An example of that would be certain lodgepole pine populations that need to have intense heat in order to release their seed cones. Another example is the giant sequoia just in the Sierra Mountains that is the most conifer-resistant, fire-resistant tree in the world, and it's capable of resisting fires in its crowns. And when a fire does eventually kill one of the giant conifers, the seedlings come back. And so centuries later, you have another giant conifer. So it's this kind of the circle of life that fire really is about in these forests.
So death and destruction is part of life.
It is. It's all linked together. There's no waste in nature. Everything is used in the cycle of life.
Now, Jack Williams, when we look at what you've been up to recently, I see that there's the big State of the Trout report right in front of you. Tell us a bit about the formation of that whole process.
Sure. So, at Trout Unlimited, we've been gathering data, as the states do and federal agencies do, on trout, native trout populations around the country, and we decided to put it all together and kind of see what it told us. The picture wasn't real rosy. We looked at 28 different species and subspecies of trout across the country, and there are three that are already extinct. There's six that are on the endangered species list, and most of the others occupy less than 25% of their historical range. So quite a few problems, and some of the same ones. We're looking very strongly at climate change, drought, wildfire, and invasive species. So, a lot of the same problems that frankly affect the terrestrial systems affect the aquatic systems as well. They're just sometimes a little bit more out of sight and kind of out of mind.
Do different fish tell us different things about forest ecosystems? I mean, are we going to learn something different from trout about forest health than we would learn from more migratory species like salmon and steelhead?
Yeah, I think so. And it in part, it depends on the context, their relationship to the ecosystem. So, you know, we were talking just a minute ago about wildfire, and that affects a lot of our trout resources. And some of them can do fairly well with fire, as Dominic mentioned. It's a natural part of the system. But unfortunately, a lot of our populations are already fragmented, populations are isolated, and we have a lot of native trout populations that are just in small little stretches of headwater streams. And those headwater streams are very vulnerable to drought and wildfire and things like that. Historically, they were in well-connected systems so that fish could actually move away from disturbances like wildfire. And then as those disturbances passed and those habitats restored themselves, they could move back up through the stream network and occupy those same habitats. And that doesn't work when those populations and habitats are fragmented by small dams or other kinds of problems.
So trout aren't migratory fish per se, but they do move around. They will cover some ground.
Yeah, they do move around quite a bit, more than most people would think. We have things, for example, in Oregon, like coastal cutthroat trout. They can move around down to estuaries and actually get in the ocean. A lot of our fish do move around quite a bit, much more than we often think.
Jack Williams is the chief scientist at Trout Unlimited. Dominic Della Sala, president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute. We're talking about forests and fire and water, and you're welcome to join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. 800-838-3760 is the phone number to call to take part in the conversation. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of what goes on, particularly with water and forests and what the effect is on fish, tends to focus on water temperature. Give us some idea of how critical that is, Jack.
Well, obviously, fish like salmon and trout are very dependent on cool, clean water supplies. And as we lose, this year has been kind of a double whammy along much of the West Coast. We've had low flow conditions, which have been stressing the fish, and then warm temperatures on top of that. And, so that gets quickly very detrimental in a number of ways. It can, warmer temperatures can simply increase the metabolic rate and the cost of fish to live their daily lives. But they can also affect where they can go. They can reduce habitats as streams get warmer. And they can affect the migration of salmon and steelhead. And that's a particular problem in the lower elevation main stem systems. So as you get into, the lower Umpqua, those steelhead that move into the north Umpqua have to move through lower elevation zones that are warm. Same thing with the Willamette, same thing with the John Day, same thing with the Columbia. We lost a good part of the sockeye salmon run this year in the Columbia River Basin because of warm temperatures. And it's not just stream temperatures, but it's ocean temperatures as well. And we've now got a very hot Pacific Ocean that stretches from really Baja California up into Bristol Bay, Alaska.
The blob, as we
we talk about it. Exactly. I mean, about 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than normal conditions. And the young fish, essentially the out-migrating salmon and steelhead, when they reach the ocean, they normally depend on cold, nutrient-rich, upwelling waters to feed and to prosper. And if they hit that warm water and there's no food, then their mortality rates drastically increase. So the water temperature is critical at a number of levels for these guys.
You mentioned isolated pockets of fish. We certainly watched a couple of dams come out in recent years in our region, and continuing process this year where there's dams coming off of, is it Evans Creek?
Evans Creek.
Yeah.
Yep.
Tributary to the Rogue River, pretty close to the city of Rogue River itself.
Right.
As this work goes on, are we seeing fewer isolated pockets of fish? I mean, is it helping trout in particular?
Well, trout in particular, I think we're doing a lot of work on dams that benefit salmon and steelhead, and that's largely what the Evans Creek situation is, and that's very helpful. Ironically, though, we have seen some cutthroat trout moving around in the Rogue system as dams have come out. But across the West, We still have a lot of isolated, small isolated populations of trout that exist in, you know, just a couple of tenths of miles of streams. And we've often done that because of problems with invading fish coming from downstream. So we've tried to isolate them to protect their genetic purity and protect them from hybridizing with a non-native trout or something like that. But we now find that a lot of these really small populations that we've created are much more susceptible to things like wildfire or drought. And so a lot of our work with trout, frankly, is water management and trying to improve water delivery, trying to, as we see, less snowpack, trying to do things to keep water up in the headwaters. We have a saying that we try to slow it, spread it, and sink it, which is the idea of keeping water up in the headwaters longer to kind of mitigate for less snowpack. We do that through riparian improvement. We do that through wet meadow improvement. We do that through beaver reintroduction. Essentially, however we can keep water up in the headwaters longer, that's a great benefit to just basically how the watershed works and how water is handled and delivered in watersheds. And that not only benefits trout and salmon, but that benefits people too, downstream agricultural users and everybody else. When we can keep the water quality good, when we can improve the timing of delivery and keep those base flows up this time of year, late in the summer, in the spring, you know, that improves basic watershed function. So that's what we do a lot of.
Forests and forest health and fish and fire and rivers all on the table today on the Jefferson Exchange. Jack Williams, Chief Scientist at Trout Unlimited. Dominic Della Sala, President and Chief Scientist at Geos Institute. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about the effects of wildfire on streams. And what are some of the direct effects, Dominic, that you see after a wildfire, the things that happen that will change the character of a stream up in the woods?
Yeah, it's always kind of scary being a terrestrial ecologist sitting alongside one of the preeminent aquatic scientists in the country, but here it goes. So there's always an interaction between terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems. What happens in the terrestrial system affects the aquatics and vice versa, right? So in a wildfire, what we see is called a pulse disturbance compared to a chronic disturbance. So a pulse disturbance is short-lived. A fire happens and you get sediment runoff from the loss of vegetation. The soils begin to slough off hillsides at a certain rate going into the streams. That affects fish for a couple of years. But it's also interesting that the sediment runoff is also associated with high levels of macroinvertebrate productivity. Fish food does really good with the pulse of nutrients into those streams. And the fish do really well, as Jack mentioned, if they can get around in the watershed. By far, the bigger impact is when you have too many roads in a system, when you've got dams blocking migration, when you've got too much clear cutting on the hillsides. Those cause chronic disturbances that go on for decades. Fish have more difficult time rebounding from those kinds of disturbances. Wildlife have more difficult times rebounding from those disturbances. In general, wildlife, fish, plants are all resilient to fires because this has been going on for millennia. They're not as resilient to the kinds of disturbances that we put on the landscape. So a wildfire is a natural disturbance compared to logging, roads, dams, mining, grazing, which have chronic effects on ecosystems.
You mentioned roads, and I noticed just on a hike the other day that there was a deep draw to the right of me and a deep draw to the left of me, and there was the road right on top of it. And I realized way down there was the pipe that ran the stream through there. Do culverts have a major effect on, when you build a road and you make a fill like that, you're essentially going across the stream with something other than a bridge. How much do those affect fish and stream health, for example?
Again, you're asking a terrestrial ecologist.
I guess I should be looking at Jack for this one.
Yeah, you might want to have Jack field out one.
Well, you know, as Dominic said, roads are are a significant problem because they really intercept that rainfall and channel it down certain ways. And as you say, culverts are a very common feature of the landscape. And, you know, they cause there are several issues related to culverts. One, of course, is that they're not always designed with kind of fish movement in mind, right? So you've seen
– to get the water out rather than get fish
exactly,
in.
Exactly. So you've seen probably kind of – we call them kind of perched culverts that – where the water kind of cascades off the end of the culvert and you know, creates essentially a small dam for fish. So that's one issue is kind of passage and movement of species that's inhibited by culverts. The other one, at least if they're poorly designed, the other problem is, of course, plugging of culverts, debris flows, and essentially blowing them out. And, you know, we have a lot of culverts that are just they're not sized properly, that maybe there's a lot of forest management activities or other road building activity that contributes a lot of debris that piles up at the top of culverts. And as we get storms, essentially it just blows it out and adds a lot of debris and material and sediment, fine sediment, which is always a big problem for these fish. So yeah, that's a huge issue. And again, it's an interesting thing when you think about it. I mean, and Dominic has it exactly right. There's these extreme pulse events that these ecosystems and these species evolved with that that they can deal with. But you combine those with these chronic disturbances like fine sediments coming in from the road system, and that spells trouble. So that's really the issue, is kind of understanding the place in time that these systems are in. And then we're seeing more fires, we're seeing bigger disturbances. In the east, we're dealing with just the opposite. Ironically, we're dealing with floods and how that is impacting our ecosystem, because we're seeing a much greater frequency of large storm events. And so, you know, we get an opposite perspective kind of from the climate change side in the east when we go from east to west. So all these are kind of fascinating issues scientifically. But the bottom line is that some of our resources can be badly damaged. And they can be damaged by our response to these problems just as much as they can by the problems themselves. So, for example, in the east where we get floods, people want to go in and they want to channelize the rivers and really separate the rivers from the floodplains, which is a problem, and move the water, you know, quickly past their community. And what we advocate is really reconnecting those rivers and floodplains so that flood water can spread out, that energy can dissipate. And really, the systems can handle floods in a more natural way. And I think that's somewhat analogous to what we talk about with wildfires and drought in the West. It's these systems are built to handle these disturbances, but we just have to make sure that they're in the proper condition to do so.
So we've got this point where we think in terms of hard lines, land here, water there, and you're saying they're going to mingle.
Yeah, exactly, and they have to, you know, that's why we focus so much of our management on what we call riparian areas, that kind of green lush strip of vegetation right along streams. These are the areas that get both. They're very dynamic parts of the landscape for sure, and they get disturbances from both floods and drought from the stream side, and they get disturbances from things like fire and land uses that come in from the upland areas. So those riparian areas are very critical systems. They're kind of the key, I think, to the what we call the aquatic conservation strategy in like the Northwest Forest Plan and some of the other forest plans. You know, how wide these riparian zones are, how they're managed, and yeah, that's really important, because that's going to allow us to filter out a lot of the impacts that are happening in the upland areas, a lot of the road impacts, if we have good, proper, wide riparian zones along our streams.
You mentioned beaver reintroduction, which implies dams, granted somewhat smaller and more natural dams, but we're still talking about having sections of isolation here, aren't we?
You know, we're not actually. It's amazing how fish can get by woody structures. You know, we used to remove log jams in streams, thinking that salmon couldn't get by them. And we now find they can. And it's the same thing with beaver dams. They can work through, they can work around, they can do a lot of those kinds of things. So the beaver dams, and they're often temporary too. They may get blown out in high water in the spring and then rebuild during the summer. So it's that critical time when we can just slow down the water enough, and as those beaver dams do slow down the water, it tends to sink into the shallow aquifers, and that improves our flows later in the year.
All right, so we've got about 2 minutes left here. Let's see if we can sneak in a call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jack Williams and Dominic Della Sala.
Yes, I question what Dominic said earlier about a wildfire being natural. What is not natural is all of the regrowth after clear cutting that has been so pervasive in the West, and it has resulted in quite a bit of alarm in California just as we speak because of the rapid spread of a wildfire in the forest, because the forest is not old growth.
Okay. Let's give him a chance to respond. Thanks for the call, Carter. Appreciate it. Dominic?
I couldn't have said it better to myself. So he's absolutely right, but I just want to clarify one point, that wildfire is a natural process. What we do to the lands are not natural, and so we can prime the fire pump by converting fire-resistant and fire-resilient native forests to flammable tree plantations. Last year, there was a fire that burned just east of Green Springs, hit slash piles from clear cuts that were all over the landscape, and blew up. So we see that repeatedly. These big fires are being primed in part by how we manage the landscape through clear cutting.
And if I could add, too, they're being primed, I think, by drought as well. So when we don't have a snowpack, when we have a lot of drying, a lot of drought conditions, the fuels out there, as we call them, are super dry. And then that fire behavior is even going to be more extreme in those really, really dry conditions.
As California is seeing in a big way this year. Lots of interesting stuff here from Jack Williams, Chief Scientist at Trout Unlimited, Dominic Della Sala, President and Chief Scientist at the Geos Institute. They'll be speaking Thursday evening at 7 at ScienceWorks in Ashland in a program called Born of Fire and Carved by Rivers. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange for Preview.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, and that'll do it for this segment of the Exchange.